The routine is something different. The routine is meant to actually wake up or agitate, if you will, your ideal mindset. So that's what it's for. It's physical things that you do that are paired with psychological states.
What does it take to do the impossible? What does it take to level up your game like never before? What does it take for individuals, organizations, for even institutions to achieve paradigm shifting, nothing is ever the same again, breakthroughs?
Our mission is to decode the neurobiology of flow and cognitive peak performance. Access the minds of maverick scientists, groundbreaking innovators, and world-leading experts to understand what it takes to achieve ultimate human performance. So you can feel your best, perform your best, and accomplish your boldest goals. I'm your host, Rian Darris, and together with best-selling author Stephen Kotler, I present to you Flow Research Collective Radio.
Hey there, Rian Darris here with the Flow Research Collective, and welcome to another episode of Flow Research Collective Radio. Now, in this episode, we are joined by Dr. Michael Gervais. Dr. Gervais is a high-performance psychologist, and his client roster includes all sorts of epic folks, from sports MVPs to internationally acclaimed artists and Fortune 100 CEOs. Mike's also the co-founder of Compete to Create, which has built a framework to enhance high-performance cultures by focusing on mindset training for individuals. You've likely come across Mike's phenomenal podcast, Finding Mastery, and you may know him as the Seattle Seahawks' infamous mindset coach. Now, in this episode with Mike, he highlights the mindset needed to harness pain and struggle for your benefits so that you can break through to the next level. We also get into discussing what reaching your potential actually means from a scientific standpoint. And Mike also breaks down how to discover your personal philosophy and use that to steer your life in a desirable direction. It's a really great episode, and Mike's eloquence and the degree to which he leverages nuance when talking about these topics always blows me away. I want to take a moment though before we dive in and just tell you about the Flow Trainer Accelerator. The Flow Trainer Accelerator is a program designed specifically for coaches, consultants, and service providers who want to develop expertise in flow science and master a framework for coaching flow and peak performance. So if you want to become a peak performance coach and do work similar to the likes of Dr. Mike Gervais here, then this potentially is a good starting point for you. It's designed around four main pillars. The first thing that we focus on is your own individual performance. We're going to help you level up your own habits and practices and protocols so that you feel like you're firing on all cylinders and performing at maximum output so that you're practicing what you preach. You know, if you're going to be coaching others in peak performance, you got to be living that too. Now, the second pillar of the Flow Trainer Accelerator involves turning you into a domain expert on the science of flow. We've packed an entire master's degree worth of resources into this training so that you can emerge out the other end of it, able to speak about these topics with authority, confidence, and clarity. The third thing that we're aiming to do here is level up your skills in the art of coaching. We give you everything needed from a full understanding of the fundamentals of coaching through to the Flow Research Collective coaching framework and all of the science that it's based on, which shows you exactly how to coach flow. And finally, joining the Flow Trainer Accelerator means joining a network of like-minded peak performers who are aspiring to be more, to do more, and to serve at a higher level. This network's going to level you up, hold you accountable, and support you through tough times on your journey. So if this sounds like you, if you're a mission-driven, craft and client-focused coach, then you can apply for the Flow Trainer Accelerator at flowforcoaches.com. So that's flowforcoaches.com. Drop onto that page, pop through an application, and we're excited to speak with you to see if training with us to become a flow or peak performance coach makes sense. We're capping our current cohort at about 50 spots, which we're expecting to pack out pretty fast, and by now it probably is close to there. So if this is of interest, I encourage you to dash over to flowforcoaches.com and apply. Dr. Michael Gervais, big warm welcome.
Thank you guys. Really great to be here. Thanks for including me in your mission and your community. I'm excited to see where Stephen takes us.
I am incredibly excited about today. Michael Gervais is one of my absolutely favorite people on the planet. I think he is one of easily the 10 smartest people on the planet on ultimate human performance. I love his mind. He's also, I think he actually was the first board member at the Flow Research Collective. I think you were the first person I called. And we've been working with Mike on a bunch of different research and a bunch of different projects. We'll talk about some of that along the way. Anyways, it's amazing to have you. And the goal today, just so you know, we're going to try to bring you. We've spent a lot of time over the course of this series focusing on really baseline peak performance in times of crisis. We talked about really kind of down-regulating the nervous system, a lot on mindfulness, gratitude, those kinds of practices. Today, we're going to try to go to the deep end of the pool and really talk about upper-level performance and look at that stuff. We may drift back down to the peak performance basics because Mike's an expert on a lot of that stuff, but we're going to try to keep it high for you.
All right, Mike. So I'm going to dive straight into a question about Warrior's Edge, and we can take it from there. So I'd love you to just tell us a little bit more about your work with Warrior's Edge. It's fascinating, and I think there's lots of different ways in which the work you do for military personnel could be helpful for other essential workers, and we'd love to hear your thoughts on that. So let's kick it off there.
Okay, thank you. So let me tell the origin story first and then get right into Warrior's Edge. And never did we imagine that what we'd be talking about right now with Warrior's Edge would be so timely. But it was a handful of years ago, Coach Carroll, head coach of the Seattle Seahawks, he was in the hallway and he's coming out of the hallway. This is in the training center. And he says, "Mike, can you feel this? This is as we are heading into the Super Bowl." And I was like, "Yeah." You know, and what he was referring to was the way it felt in the organization to have 100 and some alpha competitors with their noses pointed in the same direction. It was amazing. And he says, "Do you think anyone outside of sport would be interested in what we're doing?" And what he's talking about is his genius is really about creating a structure and a system for people to be able to do their very best work, their most meaningful, their highest capabilities to express them together. And the code name for that is a culture. So he's really good at putting together the systems that support a culture. And then if you layer his genius with my skill set on, what I'm focusing on are the mental skills to help people pursue their collective capabilities. And so he says, "Let's just write it down." So we wrote it down, like what we were doing together, our insights, our practices. And then we shared it with some business folks. And they said, "Oh yeah." And one of those business folks was Satya Nadella, who's the CEO of Microsoft. And they said, all of them collectively, like, this is good. You know, our people matter. And you're showing us how you've conditioned and trained the minds of people that are elite in sport, how to help them pursue their upper best and to do it collectively. So that's where it started. And then that turned into a thriving little business. And what we ended up doing on the back end of that is we said, what can we do to serve the military, first responders, those folks that are in the trenches, where the real consequences are potentially life and death. And so we partnered up with a warrior, a hero, Dr. Janelle McCauley, who also has her PhD in psychology. She was a pilot. And we took the core of our work. We adopted it from her intel on how to serve military folks. And here's the fun part. It's called Warrior's Edge. And right now for all of 2020, we're offering for first responders for the entire year, we're offering that 8-week online course free for all first responders.
Wow.
We're saying, we see you, we want to support you, thank you. And so it's flat out free. And I'm stoked to talk about that. So thank you for letting me lead off with that.
Totally. Now, I'd love to hear more about the course itself. And, you know, when you say mental skills, what are the kinds of things that you guys get into in the course?
So everything's grounded in science and then anchored against ancient wisdoms. So science and ancient wisdoms, and then it has to pass the sniff test that it works on the frontier in rugged environments, whether that's, you know, backcountry stuff that Stephen and family are familiar with, or it's inside of, you know, an NFL franchise. And so we've got innovation, we've got ancient wisdoms, and we got grounded in science, and we've broken it up into 5 pillars. The first pillar is self-discovery. Get to know yourself. Right? It is our life effort. It's our life work to know who you are. It's not my life work to know you. It's your life work to know you. And so we have a process to help people with self-discovery. We help them through how to train mental skills, what those are and how to train them. Help them with a psychological framework, which is really how you understand yourself and then how you explain events in your life, right? And so that's psychological framework, fancy word, but we explain that. And then we get into the science and art of recovery. And the last is mindfulness. And so those are the five pillars. And then you double click under each one of those, you know, for the actual trainings.
Great. That's super interesting. So how do you balance what works or what passes the sniff test with what is scientifically valid? I know you're a clinician, so I'm curious how you think about that.
So as a classically trained psychologist with a specialization in sport and performance, and if there was a subspecialty, it would be in high stakes environments, but there is no such thing. So it's understanding the framework from science, but then if it doesn't work with alpha competitors, if it doesn't work with the people who are saying, hey, listen, I want to trust you, but are you going to get me hurt? Are you going to cost me a lot of money? Are you going to, you know, like if I follow what we're doing and we go down the wrong hole, like this could be consequential in a lot of ways. Sometimes it's life, sometimes it's limbs, sometimes it's money, sometimes it's reputation. And so it's got to pass that sniff test. And I don't have time to share my life. I want to share my life mission in a minute, but I don't have time to waste other people's time. I don't have the makeup for it, you know, to meander. It's not my makeup. And so I appreciate the art. I appreciate science. And it's the intersection between those two that really leads to innovation for me and for our team. And so that's a long way of saying it just has to work.
It's a good point.
One thing on self-discovery, and it's a weird geeky question, of course. One of the things that we do a lot of this in flow sense, it's very useful as you move on in peak performance to be able to identify neurochemicals in your system. Oh, this is what norepinephrine feels like. So I'm hypervigilant, but I'm also a lot of anxiety. This is dopamine, et cetera, et cetera. Have you ever found any way to teach people that? Teach people how different neurochemicals feel in the body. Do you ever go that way?
And just to add to that, Mike, the way, Stephen, that you've described it before that I found extremely helpful is cognitive literacy. It's the idea of just being able to have a subjective awareness of, you know, what neurochemicals are present.
What goes on in your body when we're performing at our best is the cognitive literacy. And I think neurochemical awareness, neuroscientists, psychologists sort of know it instinctively. You figure it out along the way. But if that's, you work with a lot of athletes who get drug tested, I work with a lot of corporate people, soldiers, and another group that you can't use drug examples with them because they don't have any experience there. And I'd rather not if I could avoid it anyways.
Okay. So when I hear you talk about it, what you're describing to me is, do you help people become more aware of a particular state? There's lots of states that we can be in, right? And I'm not trying to help them say, oh, this is dopamine. I'm trying to help them understand or even finely tune how to articulate their state. But I'm not interested to help them understand the neurochemicals. I'm interested in them saying, you know, building reference points about this is a state that's optimized, that's ideal. It's something that I want to experience more often. And then backing in from that, a methodology, a practice, a set of experiences that lead to that state more often. And we can go top down or bottom up, right? We can go at it both directions. And I think a top down and bottom up from a psychological perspective and a biological perspective as the bottom up or environment up. And so we can do it from those two ways, from both a priming experience, and we can also do it from an awareness state. Okay, so let me slow down for a minute. The priming is really important. But the priming for what? And so I'll just call it something simple, which is your ideal mindset, right? And if you want to put it in a context, ideal competitive mindset, ideal artistic mindset, ideal relationship mindset. And so a mindset is a word that captures the way that you lean in to a particular environment. Okay, so mindset is, it's your psychology basically, right? But it's like the word psychology can scare people. So we can set our mind, that's the top down, but we have to know what we're setting it toward, which is the ideal state. So we can set our mind, and then the bottom up is like, what does it feel like when I'm in that state? And then that's the calibration. And so the way I think about it, to oversimplify this a little bit more, is that we're making micro decisions, micro choices, micro adjustments to try to get that tuning fork snapped into a good vibe, you know, a good tone, if you will.
I want to ask one follow-up. When you think about pre-performance rituals, you talked about priming. So when you think about pre-performance rituals, I know you. We've talked about some of this stuff between us and other podcasts that you've done with the Seahawks to prime them into kind of group flow states for the game. When you think about pre-performance routines, how many steps do you like? How do you vary it? How do you think about it? Are you using the routine to try to actually put people into flow, or are you trying to put them at the edge of flow so once they actually get into the game, that does the rest, etc.?
Let me start with a note, and then I'll concretely answer your question, is that I'm not a fan of routines. And the reason is because when you think about the highest level, it is the experience of breaking form. So it's from structure to break structure, right, is where we're trying to get to. And I'm not sure that adding structure helps people break structure. So the routines are nested in a particular phase of development. And they are substandard to the phase, which is like, hey, let's go. Whatever it is, right? Whether it's a hard conversation, whether it's a something you're going to huck, you know, off the back country, you know, or if it's presentation, fill in the blanks, right? Or it's snapping the ball and getting a toss off, whatever it might be. It's like the ultimate state is, hey, let's go. And if I need to do something at some point in my arc of my professional understanding of how to be more present and be more me, and I need a structure and routine, okay, that's where it sits. And to concretely ask, and let me actually slow down, because in elite sport, we think about periodization. So there's phases, right, that we walk people through. And during some phases, it's messy. We're actually seeing some decreases in performance. And we know that anytime you introduce a new intervention, you introduce a new skill that you're going to work on, there's a natural dip in performance. So part of the science is knowing the art, when to introduce it in an arc of somebody, you know, and then when not to muddle with something. To concretely answer your question is, I'm a fan of something like three things, right? Like one, two, three things that you do. And then this, what we're priming toward is to be in that state. And that state is, it's a presence with an ideal mindset. That gets them right to the edge to find their ability to trust themselves, to be curious, to take risks, to be on that emotional, mental frontier to let it go, to let go.
Mike, the way I'm interpreting that, I'm not sure if I'm totally off, but are you sort of saying that so it's a reliance on an ability to get into a state versus on a routine? So you want to get yourself to that state, ideally with minimal routine rather than be relying on a routine.
Oh, yeah. So in that arc that we're talking about, a periodized program, there's times that we need to practice things, right? And that practice is okay for a pre-performance routine, but knowing that we're going to let go of that, right? At some point, right? In the arc of mastery, at some point, we're going to let go of that. And that's the breaking of form. That's the inviting of chaos. That's like, listen, you two are really good at what you do. I doubt you did a pre-performance routine before you turned on your mics and set up your camera. I doubt it.
Let's do push-ups.
I want to ask you a question though, because I do for skiing have a pre-performance routine, right? I have a thing I do the top 30 seconds of the lift, especially if I'm going to go ski something. Really, it's nothing more than like, you know, putting in my headphones and like wiggling my hips to loosen up my hips, but gets me ready to go. I've never in my life been able to find something, because the state that put me into is not a state I want to write in, right? So I've never been able to find a pre-performance. I mean, I have my morning routine, but it's basically like get from bed to desk as fast as possible and get into it, right? And know that the first couple minutes are going to suck, and then I'm into it. I've often wondered, is there like something I could do for 3 seconds? The only thing I really do is I have to walk from my house to my office, and I always look at the stars because it's 4 o'clock in the morning, so it's night on. I always look at I can usually see the Big Dipper and the rest of the galaxy. So I do that.
Yeah,
but it's not, it doesn't do what the skiing one does.
Well, I think what you're describing there is structure. You've got some structure, and that structure helps to keep with some cadence, with some, you know, growth arcs. But the routine is something different. The routine is meant to actually wake up or agitate, if you will, your ideal mindset. So that's what it's for. It's physical things that you do that are paired with psychological states, right? And so for a classic, super simple, concrete example is like this is what I used to do when I played a bunch of like hoops down in the, I didn't play college hoops, but I played a bunch of hoops at that time.
Because you're 6'9".
Yeah, right. I tie my shoes, and as I was tying my shoes, I say, fast feet, lock it down. And then I kind of pull the bow down. I get to my other shoe and I say, trust your open shot, move your feet, lock it down. So this was me practicing, you know, getting my mind right. Mm-hmm. It's that simple. You know, it's just, they're little physical things that you do to get to a mental state, if you will. It's considered a skill.
Mike, I'd love to hear some examples of pre-performance rituals, or when you mentioned 1, 2, 3, could you dive a little more deeply into what you mean by that?
I'm a fan of thresholds. So crossing through thresholds, like sometimes when you cross through, it's this natural kind of physical structure that you're passing through. And it's like drop something, grab something, you know, like let go of something, you know, to activate something. Or it's just this purposeful kind of moment. And so maybe it's just kind of putting your head up and your shoulders back and you say something like, let's fucking go, you know, whatever it might be, whatever the vibe is for you. And so I'm a fan of thresholds and I'm a fan of making it really simple. And I'm also a fan of saying you don't need any of them, because the end game is to put yourself into the present moment in an ideal state. You don't need a routine to do that. If a routine can help you get there, great, use it, play with it. But it's not something that's supposed to lock you. You know, it's something that's supposed to just support you and nudge you.
Just to put some context around this, there is a long history in kind of peak performance psychology and coaching of coaching people to develop fairly complicated pre-performance routines, 10 to 15, 20 minute, do all these different things, visualizations to bring back memories of times, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So what we're talking about is both of us are a fan of shrinking that down massively into something that is very, very deployable, you know, in real world situations. Essentially what we're discussing is what's the ideal 3-second version of what the literature says should take 15, 20 minutes. So that's essentially the framing around the discussion.
And then I'd even argue, like, I'm take it one step further. I'm not sure that it's even the right thing to even talk about too much, you know, because it's like people want to glob onto something, and that glomming is really, I'm not sure that's the right thing. It's almost like I'm so fatigued right now, you guys, with like tactics. And I feel like I've been turned upside down, grab my ankles, and like I feel like people want to shake the lint out of my pockets. Like, well, okay, what are the secrets? There's no freaking secrets. There are none.
One of the questions Stephen loves getting asked is, you know, what do I do Monday morning to get into flow?
Yeah, I mean, there's no hacks. I'm sorry if you're vibing on the hacks. There are no hacks. You don't want Stephen or myself or Rian or your surgeon or your tattoo artist or your car driver to be a hack. Why would you want to be a hack? You don't want, if it's serious, you don't want hacks. What you want is wisdom. What you want is insight. What you want is something durable that's also nimble. That's a psychological framework we're talking about. That takes time. But the way to increase the sturdiness of it is time in present moment. And so we can talk about what are the practices to get to the present moment more often. What are the things that pull you out of it? That's really cool. And the idea like that there's like, if I could just do a couple things, I'm glad you're fatigued with it too. It's a fundamental commitment. It's a fundamental orientation to design your life around fill in the blank.
Yes.
And then that thing, whatever the blank is, ought to be your purpose.
Yeah, that's right.
And it damn well better produce flow. Like it's gotta be it peaks. Three levels of happiness, according to positive psychology, right? How you are in the moment, happiness. Then there's the high flow lifestyle, enjoyment, engagement. And the highest one is purpose and meaning, which is a high flow lifestyle coupled to a cause greater than yourself. And the cause greater than yourself, by the way, just so we can demystify purpose, it works because passion is so damn selfish, it can be obsessive and dangerous, A. And B, When you get the focus off yourself, you need external focus, task-specific focus to generate flow, to generate high performance. So if it's too internal, right, that will screw up everything else you need. So purpose gets it outside yourself. And bonus, passion will get you a shit ton of dopamine, which is a great motivator in a sense, but purpose gets you dopamine and oxytocin. And that's a really big winning combo that lasts. So purpose is super, super, super important, but it gets really mystified. And it's actually simple. It's about where we put our focus and what neurochemicals we recruit. For those of you who want to be seriously reductionistic with me.
One of the things I've heard you talk about on this note, and especially with respect to durability, is the idea of a personal philosophy. And I know you said you wanted to mention your own personal mission, which I'm sure relates to that. Could you tell us a little bit about your thinking on having a personal philosophy and then your own personal mission?
Yeah, for sure. Okay, so what is a philosophy? You know, like, let's start there. And everybody has a philosophy. Whether you can articulate it or not is something different. Whether you really deeply understand it is different. But a philosophy is a set of guiding principles. Guiding what? Guiding your thoughts, your words, and your actions. So the principles that you hold dearly help inform the thoughts you have, the words you choose, and the actions you take. Now, what do I mean you already have a philosophy? You bought a car or didn't, you know, you chose, maybe you bought a bicycle. You are renting or you bought a home in a certain part of a city, in a certain part of the country, you know, like certain part of the planet. So these are your actions, the words that you choose, the words you choose to yourself and others. Those are all referenced against your guiding principles. So when I think about it that way, I say, well, why not just know what your guiding principles are? Why not really know them? And then you've almost got like these pillars to bounce up against when you are trying to figure out, like, how do I maximize or optimize, or how do I find a deeper sense of joy or happiness or freedom? Like, and these pillars, these guiding principles will inform your thoughts, your words, and your actions. And when you have all three of those lined up, that's good now. When your thoughts, your words, and your actions are lined up, it's really powerful. Then what allows you to do is have that sturdiness that I was talking about earlier, and you can progressively move into more challenging environments. And what you're doing is you're testing your technical skill lined up against, can I really maintain the integrity of me, my thoughts, my words, and my actions? Actions is really about the technical skill. And if the integrity of the framework starts to rock or shake or break or crumble, you got to go back to the drawing board. It's not hard, right? But the principles are foundational. And so we challenge people to do that alone work. Nobody can give them to you. You can adopt and use other people's brilliance, but it's alone work. There's nobody that can give you your purpose. There's nobody that can give you your philosophy. As a awake adult, it is your responsibility to know them. And so that's how I think about philosophy. That's where I go with the importance of philosophy.
Hey, this is Rian again. Hope you're enjoying Dr. Gervais' Mind right now. I want to take a moment just to remind you that if you're a coach, a consultant, or a service provider, and you want to become an expert in the science of peak performance, like Mike or Stephen here, so that you can coach your clients and flow, then the Flow Trainer Accelerator may be a fit. So the Flow Trainer Accelerator is designed for those of you who want to develop deep scientific expertise so that you can speak about the kinds of topics that we've been covering today with authority, with credibility, and with clarity. Now, of course, you're also going to master all the frameworks needed to coach flow so that you can help others access flow more consistently too. We're capping our current cohort at 50 people, and we're looking for mission-driven, craft, and client-focused coaches only. So if that's of you and this is of interest, then just drop over to flowforcoaches.com. That's flowforcoaches.com, and you can apply for the Flow Trainer Accelerator there.
I love that. For folks who are doing that or want to do some version of this in the first place, what's an example of an exercise or what's the process look like for distilling down your personal philosophy and your guiding principles?
Okay, so the exercise is simple, right? There's three ways to get at this that I think is most effective. Mindfulness. I know you guys talk a lot about that. So mindfulness is one. A second is conversations with wise people, if you're fortunate enough to be there. And then the third is writing. It's those three. And, you know, I've got a primer that I help people walk through. It's in the online course that I mentioned earlier. And so there's no kind of magic underneath of it. It's sit and understand. And those are three mechanisms to do it: mindfulness, conversations with wise people, and then writing.
I want to ask you a clarifying question on this one. In goal setting theory, they talk about three levels of goals, like a mission statement for your life level, then your high hard goals that are the big things you have to do to accomplish that statement thing. And then your clear goals. What are you doing today? Right? Checklist kind of stuff. My question is, I've heard of a mission, like my mission statement, right? I want to write great books. I want to make the world a better place for animals. I want to advance flow science and training. That's a mission statement. It's not a philosophy. How would you talk to me about a philosophy? Because that's a component that's very unique to how you think about this thing and mm-hmm. different from how kind of most goal setting stuff works.
That's right.
So like talk about what you deeply mean by a philosophy. And I want to know where that came from for you.
Yeah. So if we look back at the most influential people on the planet, it's two general sources, right? There's the thinkers, the spiritual mystics, and those tend to be curated at the 11 world religions. And then there's activists and scientists, right? So I meant three. And so when you examine Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s approach to life, he had a very clear philosophy. I bet without any deep discovery, you know what it is, right? What would you say his philosophy is if you were to be a reductionist to this amazing man's life?
Nonviolent grit.
A grit towards equality.
Justice, right? Yeah.
Nonviolent grit towards equality. Yeah, okay.
Yeah. And so the purpose was to create a world where there was equality. And his approach towards that, his unique tone was about nonviolence. Okay. And then he had all this passion and perseverance, you know, against it. Okay. So I call passion and perseverance, those are more skills. And then the philosophy is, it's a nonviolent, equitable world that I'm looking for. The mission is day in and day out to live aligned with that, to go in every room that I can possibly be in and talk about it and be about it and demonstrate it and mobilize toward it. That's the mission. Okay. The philosophy is really love, equality. Those are philosophical notes. Nonviolence is a philosophical note. Malcolm X had a very similar philosophy, equality, but he had actually different philosophical notes by any means necessary. But his mission was still alive, right? And so then, okay, so we've got philosophy is the philosophical notes, the guiding principles. The mission is the activation of it. And we can mm-hmm. bounce out of this and talk about like military. The mission is to take the hill for what? The purpose, the bigger thing. And then the purpose would be to protect the lives of the native country that we're protecting, okay? That's the purpose. And then one step up, vision. What does it look like, feel like, sound like if that thing were to happen?
Mm-hmm.
So his vision, Dr. King's vision was like, wow, could you imagine if people could sit wherever they wanted on a bus? We could go to whatever, you know, could you imagine? And so he had this vision of what he was working toward. The mission was real to him and the purpose was clear. These are all, I know it sounds like we're thin slicing, but they're very different words and meanings. But the philosophy are the guiding principles that you bounce up against to say, is this how I want to do this? It's the how, not the mechanical goal how, but the tonal mm-hmm. how, right? It's tonally. Principles are tone-based, not action-based.
So you're telling me I have to have emotions? Oh. Nobody said anything about no emotions. I don't know about this theory, Michael.
You brought that into the mix. Not me. Right. I did not bring into the mix.
All right. Let me ask it. I'm going to take it a different direction because I love this conversation. I think it's so key.
I can't believe that as like science nerds that we're talking about mm-hmm. things that struggle with science. Why are we doing this? Like, I love this, Stephen, Rian, but like as science nerds, this is the furthest we can get from science right now.
Okay, so I'm going to frame up what I'm going to in terms of the psychology and the science. the first time we were talking about this was in a conversation about developing a fear practice, learning how to really work with fear and go right at fear. And you were talking about what is really meant by self-talk, right? The power of positive thinking, which is a terrible thing, but that you, when you talk about self-talk, you ask a core question, which is, does this thought create space or not? And that's what I want you to talk about, because it's such a brilliant way of framing this up. And by the way, for the folks who want the neuroscience underneath this, what we're actually talking about are thoughts that quiet down the amygdala and lower cognitive load, essentially. So neurobiologically, they're flushing out norepinephrine and cortisol from our system. They're lowering cognitive load and they're quieting down the amygdala. That's the neurobiology. He's going to talk about it in slightly more metaphorical terms, but there's some science there. How's that, Michael?
No, good. There we go. Okay, good. So now we're back on track. I love it. And it's not that that other stuff is not important, but we're out on some really fascinating thoughts about how to organize your life, right? And there is some research that would support people that have a philosophy actually have increase in fulfillment. And also
Chris Peterson and Martin Seligman did, right? They wrote Character Strengths and Virtues, right? Mm-hmm. The virtue half of that equation. I'm suspicious of it because they got a very big Templeton grant, and Templeton was very interested in the ideas of virtues, which is very Templeton-y, but their work was really interesting, right?
That's right.
And it really did say that the best way forward, their work was on, there's a long history in peak performance of saying, hey, if you want more flow, if you want more peak performance, train up strengths. And they took it a step further and they said, okay, first link those strengths to these six, I think it was six core virtues that were broken into 24 subcategories. Okay. So bravery, there was courage, but it was bravery and a couple other things and whatever. Yep. So there's absolutely a bunch of new work on that stuff that says, hey, this is harder science than, you know, whatever. But I get your point and you're totally right.
Yeah, good. So that's very cool. Let's go back to the self-talk thing. Maybe I'm old on this thought, but my eyes roll and my stomach churns, unless you're going to coach me up on this, that this idea that we've got 60,000 thoughts a day. I mean, I've seen some math on it and I'm like, what are we doing? I just need to say this, is that your relationship with yourself is met in a dialogue with yourself. Like, that's what it is. And so let's oversimplify how we have a dialogue or exchange or a thinking process. Some want to call it cognition, whatever. Just let's call it a dialogue that we're either constricting or creating space based on the words we choose, the phraseology we have, the tone of that phraseology, the intent and meaning around it. It's either creating space neurochemically, physiologically, psychologically, or it's creating constriction. And I'm not saying that one is better than the other. I'm saying to have a sense of mastery is to know how to create space, how to create constriction, when to create space, when to be able to create constriction, and to be able to toggle up and down with some sort of volitional ability, you know, where you sit in the driver's seat of you. And now we can get into a weird place. I love it about consciousness, if you want. I mean, that's a whole different kind of thing, but to make it super concrete, to put some handles on it, the words you choose and the phrases you use create constriction or space. That's a basic foundational thought that has helped me quite a bit and help athletes that I work with quite a bit.
There's a Wittgenstein addition to this idea, right? He wrote famously, the limits of my language are the limits of my world, which people don't realize, but what language serves a framing function.
That's
brain.
Right.
It's how we take inchoate feelings and a bunch of shit that we can't quite, and we put a frame by it. We say, it is this thing, and it's very limiting, it's very liberating. And the example of the liberation I like, it's in Last Tango, is for thousands of years, religions have been trying to get us to treat each other fairly and not so good. And in the mid-1800s, out of art theory emerged this concept of empathy, right? They're trying to figure out, how can I look at a painting and feel what the creator felt? And they come up with the word empathy, and they come up with the idea of empathy. And within 10 years of this word showing up in language, and people championed it, and Rilke wrote about empathy as a superpower, and it became a big deal. But you had the women's suffrage movement got started, anti-slavery got started, animal rights got started. All these three things show up within 10 years, full throttle of us having a word for this thing that we've been trying to create.
Yeah. And you know, some of the romance languages have more words to describe love, and we don't, you know, I mean, imagine once we get a little bit better at just having some science and some words and some framing for ideal mindsets, ideal states, you know, like we have mindset now.
Okay. So now let me ask you a geeky psychological question that I don't understand on mindset. And I want to ask Carol Dweck this, but I haven't done it yet. What the hell is the difference between locus of control and a mindset? Because as far as I can tell, they're the same thing. So locus of control is this idea that says we either have an internal locus of control, which means I believe I am in control of my life and I am the master of my fate one way or another, or even external locus of control, which means life happens to you. And we know there's overwhelming evidence that says if you have an external locus of control, if you think life happens to you, you cannot have peak performance. It's gone. It goes out the window. It's not actually possible. So it's a grounding thing, much like a growth mindset is necessary, but I've never understood what the hell's the difference.
I've never been asked this question, so let me play with this a little bit. Is that a mindset is, it's more of an approach. Okay, so when I work with athletes about their ideal mindset, I ask them to describe it. And there's like five or six basic frames that people use. They go, "Ooh, ideal? I'm nasty." Oh, okay. So that's how you describe ideal, nasty. Okay. "Ooh, I'm so chill." Oh, so chill. Okay. So these are two different people, right? Another one is like, "I'm just hyped." Oh, okay. So it's like, it's an approach. It's the way that they feel. So locus of control is more of an orientation. So orientation is when I'm explaining to myself or to others how things work, it's either the basic orientation is it's the external dictates the internal, or I'm responsible. And then there's layers and levels to that, right? Like just the other day, this was awesome. My son is 11 and a half and we're on a walk and he says, we're talking about a friend. He goes, "You know what I noticed, Dad, is that one of my friends, fill in the blank name, whenever something goes well, he says that he's responsible for it. But when it doesn't go well, he blames it on everybody else." And I thought, he's already built it. He's already built his internal locus of control. And my son was like, "Yeah, but it's not becoming, right? Because anytime something doesn't work, it's that, it's because of that, that, that." And what he hasn't built yet is this internal reflection to say, well, what is my responsibility to? How can I sharpen the sword? How can I actually take some responsibility back? And so there's a sophistication of locus of control as well to keep us on a growth arc. Now, a growth mindset, you can take the word mindset and put any word you want, any adjective in front of it. And then that becomes a bit more complete on the approach, right? Growth mindset is an approach to learning, even when it's hard. A competitive mindset is like, I'm going to work to be in it, even when it's hard. And what I like about the word mindset is that you can set your mind, but that takes training. What I don't like about the word mindset is that it feels blah. It feels overused. It feels like it's not special in some respect. And I'll tell you what, when people are talking about the difference between the tip of the arrow, the tip of the spear, folks, and the rest, even if you're on the arrow and you're in the top 5% of doers in the world, they're talking about the psychology. What they're talking about, though, is a very complicated, interrelated, super dynamic interplay between thoughts, words, and actions. Mindset is one part of that. But so is locus of control and explaining events. So they're separate yet related, just like all things, unfortunately, in psychology. They're separate but related. I hope that helps.
That was really great. Yeah, that was actually the first time anybody's actually managed to answer that question. I've been asking it for a while now. That was awesome. That actually does, that makes a lot of sense to me. Thank you. I got smarter, folks.
Yeah, I love appreciate that, Mike. So one question, could you unpack optimism a little bit more for us all, along with how to cultivate a more optimistic disposition, or how to try and regain some optimism in this challenge.
By the way, Michael, I want you to know I'm pessimistic about your chances of answering this question.
Yeah, good. You want to lay a bet?
I'm optimistic.
Yeah.
I love pessimists. I don't want to be one by any means, but I love them because, you know, it's like, oh, okay, you're going to help keep you alive and maybe me safe, but shit, I'm going to get on the frontier. So like, you know,
I know.
Okay, so, let's go seriously. Compete to Create is that 8-week online course. One of the central hubs that we teach is the value of optimism. It's a skill. It's also a state, which makes it really fun to talk about. And so, okay, why optimism? One, there's good research. Nothing's bulletproof, right? Nothing is ironclad. For every bit of research that I can say supports variable A, I can also cite other research that says the thing is not what you think it is. But for the most part, it's unbelievably compelling when I've been in the most, well, okay, so let's just be concrete. Super Bowl winning team. We've been to two Super Bowls, Seattle Seahawks. Coach Carroll lives and breathes optimism. He is the embodiment of optimism. Let me define it. Optimism is this idea that something good is about to happen. It's a framework. It's like when I think about the future, do I think that it's going to work out or do I think that it's probably not going to work out? I'm going to tell you this right now. I haven't been in a world leading, not class, but world leading experience with a team or individual that is not optimistic. I'd be hard pressed. Push against, I would love for anyone in your community to say, oh yeah, you know who's world's best and they don't believe it's gonna work out? It's this person. Then what are they doing? Now, maybe a comedian, you know, but
yeah.
That's part of the thing.
You see, you know? Sometimes with academics, I agree with you, right? I've spent 30 years studying those moments in history when the impossible became possible.
Right.
Everything, right? Like, you don't do that without optimism. Here's my question, Nick, one level down from this, which is the one downside of the upside of optimism is astounding in terms of at a cognitive impact, neurobiological level, it's amazing. The drawback is the optimism bias, right? And the optimism bias as a cognitive bias can be difficult. And we do know that pessimists, and I'm an optimist as well, but pessimists have a clearer view of reality. And I'm not necessarily saying a clearer view of reality is a good thing, but there are certain circumstances where it's very useful, I've found.
Oh, yeah. Like, so it's a pervasive, let's use the word pervasive. Like, I can be pessimistic. I can be optimistic. It's only those two, though. There's not something else. There's not a third thing when we think about our future. It's either optimism or pessimism. I wish there was a third. I wish there was 10 of them, but we only know of two that I know of, at least. Now, people like to think that optimism is grounded in a naivete. No, it can be. Naive optimism will keep you in a battered relationship. Naive optimism will keep you stuck thinking that you're great when you're really a garage band. You know, like naive optimism means that you don't have accurate reference points, that you don't know how to work in a sense of reality. That's what naive is about. You can also be a naive pessimist, right? But they tend not to be. They tend to be more factual about the dangers because the brain is winning for them.
Mm-hmm.
Past trauma is winning for them. That's okay. Mm-hmm. If you're a pessimist, I love you. I understand you. You are doing your very best and you're doing it for good reasons. You've been taught it or you've been burned. No problems. This is the best way for you right now. And what I'm suggesting is that it takes a lot to flip a framework, to flip an approach. It takes a lot of work to do it. And pessimists and anxious folks and depressed people, they think that there's maybe something there, but they're afraid they're going to be duped. They're going to be let down, hurt, disappointed. And that is too much. So I want to sharpen it this way. I believe, I can't find real concrete evidence here, but I believe that optimism is at the center of mental toughness. What does that mean? So mental toughness is the ability to stay in it when it's hard. That's mental toughness, to be able to adjust, be flexible, take a punch, hold your teeth, you know, like look at them and be like, okay, I'm going to figure this out. That there's a toughness to that. So optimism is a fundamental belief it's going to work out. I need to do my part. So now we're going to take locus of control. We're going to mire it with optimism, and then we're going to layer onto it self-talk, right? And then we can wrap around it with our philosophical tone of how we want to do us. And then we can backfill a bunch of other psychological skills. And then part of the framework is like, ooh, wait a minute. This is actually, I know this is what I, where I meet myself right here. Who do I want to be? That's why mindfulness is so important. Like, who do you really want to be? And so I just kind of spread out this little map, if you will, to answer something very simple, which is, I believe, I don't have the evidence for it, optimism is at the center of mental toughness. And I want to be part of people that are so tough that they can be flexible, they can be vulnerable, they can be nimble, they can adjust, they can pivot, they can create on demand, they can let go, they can laugh, they can stay in it. I want to be part of those tribes. And it's also the man I want to be. So mental toughness doesn't mean I'm going to stay in it. It's just because it's hard. That bang my head against the wall. That's an old idea of mental toughness.
Let me ask you another question about optimism. Let me frame it in a bigger question, then tuck in the optimism question. The bigger question, because I don't want you to let you go until you answer this one. The overwhelming lesson I've learned in 30 years in peak performance is most people have no idea what they're capable of. And the main reason is because excellent capability, what you would call mastery, I would guess, is an emergent property, right? It only emerges when you push on your skills at to the utmost, right? At the barrier where you need for flow over and over and over again, right? I always say learning is really difficult because the thing you're after is invisible until it's not. And excellence is learning times 1,000, right? So it's that same framework all the way up. Now, back to optimism. My question, there's a kind of optimism, and I don't often like using myself as an example because I don't think personality scales, and but it took me a really long time to develop the thing I'm talking about, which is confidence from my own successes. I learned to trust my own history, right? There would be things I was scared of, and I would stop and be like, you know what? You have actually solved this problem 400 times before, and your fear is actually the most irrational, illogical thing you've got going, because the evidence of your life is totally to the contrary. And once I started thinking that way about certain things, I learned to become optimistic in the face of Herculean difficulties, because I was like, oh yeah, these are immense, but I've been here before, right? And I've done this before. It's sort of something, you know, at one of the things athletes figure out, and, you know, I don't know, I probably learned this, unfortunately, in my 20s, is the first time you go through a catastrophic injury and you have to rebuild from scratch, it's incredibly difficult. The second time it happens, you're bummed it happened again, but you're like, oh, I know how to do this, right? And you do it. So it's that sort of thing. Anyways, that's the big frame. That's the big question.
I was so kind of lost in how you're framing it. I missed the question. So
my question is the optimism you're talking about different from the optimism that's based on past successes? Two, how do you teach people to trust their history? That level of optimism, where does that come from? Because I find it's very hard to train. And three, how do you teach people about the emergent properties of excellence and mastery in a way that when people are at the front end, they can actually stay motivated? Because it's, you know, when you're already excellent and you're getting better at it, all the things like the performance deficits, when you onboard a new skill, you're like, oh, I'm going to suck for a couple months. That's just what it is, because this is what I do. Okay, but I'll be, you know, by the end of the season, I'll be killing it, or by the end of this book, I'll be knowing how to do it. That's easy, right? Once you're an expert, it's a hell of a lot easier to onboard new skills because you don't mind it. But at the front end of the curve, this shit is a lot harder, and that's what I'm trying to gain some insight on.
God, I love it. And I'm so lost in what you just said. I missed the question. Like, can you solve, you know, like consciousness, the hard problem of consciousness? Can you solve that?
Go.
Yeah, go, go.
43, the answer is 43.
Yeah. So the first two is that you're describing are not optimism. So this might help. The first two that you're describing is actually
confidence.
Yeah, they snap to confidence or efficacy. And so efficacy is that fancy phrase for sense of power, volitional control, right? So you're snapping to confidence. But the question that you're asking specifically is, how do you help people trust their body work, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because what happens let's go software hardware for just a minute. And this is, I wish I had a better analogy, but, or metaphor, that the mind is software, the brain is hardware. And if you have weak software, the brain's going to win. And the brain, in the moment of crisis, you know, call it a thin slice of crisis, where it feels like you're going to die, because the part of your brain, that little almond shaped thing in the center of your brain, you know, that that little network that's saying, hey, your heart's pumping, or we got to get your heart pumping, we got to get your breathing changing, we got to get some sweat going, we got da 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 da, all that whole cascade that's predictable, fight, flight, freeze, submit, maybe flow. When that thing turns on and you don't have the software to regulate it, the brain will win. And that is a survival mechanism. Under that condition, it is so hard, unless you've trained it, to reference past success, because the immediacy of now is survival, and survival wins. So I'm thinking right now that you flat out already know the answer to this, and you're asking it to give me this fun little layup so I would look smart. But like, I know you know this. So maybe this is an exercise for your peoples that are listening. But the essence of it is that you have to train. You have to train. You have to externalize your hard drive. You have to get stuff out in front of you so that you can look at it. Is this my history? Is this what I, this is what I've done?
Oh,
I've
that is definitely something I do with people. I make them write down the origin story of every skill they have.
Yeah, yeah.
Including their invisible skills. The most important ones are invisible skills. Like, my favorite example is, there are people who grew up in really rough childhoods with bad households, and they learned how to diffuse an argument between angry, drunk parents. That is an amazing negotiating skill, right? It's an invisible skill. You can diffuse a drunken argument. Real. It's amazing.
It's real. So listen, fake it till you make it. Don't fake anything. It's not beautiful. It's not going to stand up for the ages. Like, right? So be about it. Be clear about what it is. And what I'm talking about on the it here are the hard things that you've done in your life. Be clear about them, and be clear about your take, your responsibility in those. You got to write that stuff down. I love your phrase, the origin story. You've got to write that stuff down so you can see it. Then you have to practice it. And you know this from, like, I don't know, theater. You need to know your lines. Then you need to practice your lines, you know? And it's so much easier in between if you really believe and understand why those words have been chosen and where they're coming from. So that's how I think about this. And those are the first two, right? The answer to your first two. And the third, what was the third one?
Emergent properties of mastery. Peak performance works like compound interest. And the crazy turbo boost, sure, you're going to get a great boost if you've onboarding practices like mindfulness, gratitude, or even regular exercise or regular sleep. Like, those, the benefits are going to be colossal at that point. And then there's a plateau. You've done all the easy stuff, and then, like, then it gets a lot more complicated. That's, to me, where peak performance actually starts. Once you've onboarded all those basics, then now welcome to peak performance. And that point is fairly, like, the big gains go away, and that stuff is compound interest. It's train. So that my question is just, literally, how do you give people confidence that it's going to work?
They have to earn confidence. I love that question. They have to earn confidence to trust their body of work. Okay, so confidence, focus, trust, these are all psychological skills. They can be developed just like any ability. And you can do it in sets and reps, you know, like, you can, that's what we need. Like, we need to oversimplify psychology. There's two basic camps. There's the discovery component, and there's the skills component. So the skills can be done in sets and reps. How do you train confidence? What are the sets and reps? It's self-talk. That self-talk has to be anchored in something that's real. And so you have to do, I can say to you, hey man, you look really smart. You know, like, I could say, you're ready, you're going to kill this. Well, it's such a temporary little thing, but it actually is setting somebody up for needing the external to dictate the internal. That's a position of weakness. Mm-hmm. So the greatest thing we can do is say, hey, let's go from the locus of control piece. Hey, we want to give you a set of tools, try these things out, know how to use all of the tools, psychological skills and principles available to you, start somewhere. But so that you are actually in control of your state, you're able to buffer against what once was pressure what once was consequential and create more space, even more space by the thinking and the patterns that you work from, the thought patterns, to create even more space so that you have more space to play. And then what actually in return takes place is you have to work a little bit harder to get up to the edge because you've, you know, and it's so, it's a bit like first person shooter or first person driver. It feels like everything's happening so fast. That's what anxiety, that's what survival, that's what depression is. It's like you're in it and you can't see from a distance what the state actually is or what the experience is because you're so absorbed by the emotional components and the thought patterns that map with those emotional experiences. So the more space that we create, the more we can kind of see what's happening. And that space at the edges, to your words, the edges of that space, the edges of our capability, of our capacity, is where we meet ourselves. It's where we greet flow state. It's where we express what we are truly capable of. And it's where we learn what we need to refine. And so those that are really fundamentally orientating their life towards their potential or the collective potential of their tribe are spending more time there, that difficult, nauseatingly hard, stomach-churning, anxious-provoking state. They're spending more time there than the rest of the world. That's the place to go get good at. Everything else that leads you to get to that place more often, those are practices. Psychological practices are the ones that we're talking about. The psychological practices, let me explain all of them, right? Like there's not many. Confidence, calm, being able to focus in the present moment, trusting yourself, resiliency, optimism, locus of control, grit.
Mindset.
These, but all of these together are the collective mindset that you have, right? And so these are all skills. And you can practice them with sets and reps. And with those sets and reps, you are more familiar with an ideal mindset for a particular environment. So anyways, I feel like I got on a soapbox there.
I love a mic. That was a mic drop.
It was great.
Mike, thank you so much. This is phenomenal. I know there's a few things of yours that we didn't get to mention because we were deep in it all.
Oh, yeah. Let's talk about the series of talks.
We got Warrior's Edge. We talked about decoding disruptors, finding mastery, compete to create. Where else can people find you, Mike? And maybe you can just say a word or two about each of those before you.
Yeah. Okay. So competetocreate.net is the online training course that the head coach of the Seattle Seahawks and I put together to share how you can train your mind to be your very best. And it's my best work. And I'm so happy to do it. And let's call it version whatever. And there's going to be iterations, but I'm really so happy to share it. And if the timing is eloquent and if the financial abilities allow you to do it, I can't imagine a better investment. So that's one. If you're a warrior and a frontline responder, we've got a customized course that is the entire duration. It's the full thing, but we just got a warrior feel to it. If you're a first line responder, the course is free for the entire year. And that's again at competetocreate.net/warriors edge. Finding Mastery is the podcast. And so Stephen, you've been a multiple time guest. I love any time, standing invitation, anytime you want to come in, like love to have you on it. Our community loves you. And so that's called Finding Mastery. Found at podcast players near you. And then we did a fun little project with Microsoft where we are working on decoding disruptors. And so it's 9 extraordinary women.
I love this project, by the way.
Oh, do you?
This is great. Yeah, I love this project.
It's 9 extraordinary women that have disrupted the narrative of their industry. And then we're wanting to understand how they've disrupted their self-narrative to be able to kind of get up into the frontier. And so that has been awesome. That's at decodingdisruptors.com, but you can find it at Finding Mastery. You can find it at Compete.
It's one of the things that I love about your podcast and this project is very few people go so far out of their way to interview top women leaders in peak performance, and you have gone really far to do that. And I love that. So I like that with this project, and I like that you do that. Well, there are 3 dudes on the screen.
Exactly. I was thinking that.
So I'm going to sound very hypocritical with this, but good on you for doing that. Thing. Not doing it
right now. But yeah, thank you so much, Mike.
Yeah. And listen, thank you for including me in your community and whatever I can do to support you guys and help you guys. And Stephen, you know how much I appreciate you as a friend and appreciate your dent that you're making in a very complicated space. and you're one of the handful of folks that are able to seriously articulate something that is invisible and difficult and complicated and to make it simple. And for that, I really appreciate the eloquence of how you've done it. So thank you. And however I can help and continue to support your mission in life, I'm about it.
Big up, Mike.
Thanks, Mike.
Appreciate you guys.
Be good, brother.
Okay. Bye,
thanks,
everybody.
Mike. All the best. Bye.
Hey there, I hope you enjoyed today's episode. I hope you enjoyed getting to spend some time with the great Dr. Michael Gervais. One quick thing before you bounce, if you want to discover what's stopping you from experiencing flow and you don't quite have the luxury of being able to work directly with someone like Dr. Michael Gervais, well then take our free flow blocker diagnostic at flowblocker.com. It's going to pale in comparison to working directly with someone like Mike Gervais, but it takes 3 minutes and it'll help you figure out a starting point for leveling up your own performance because it helps you identify what your biggest flow blocker is, whether that's lack of motivation, lack of clarity, or one of the other flow blockers that we've got in there. And then when you've taken it, we'll send you some really cool, actionable pieces of advice that'll help you overcome whatever your exact blocker is. So head over to flowblocker.com and check that out. And then finally, just to remind you, if you're a coach, a consultant, or a service provider, and you want to become an expert in flow science and learn to coach others in flow, go to flowforcoaches.com to apply to train with us through the Flow Trainer Accelerator. That's flowforcoaches.com. We would be pumped to speak with you and to see if working with us to become a peak performance or flow coach makes sense for you and for us. Now, thanks, as always, for listening to Flow Research Collective Radio. I always appreciate your time, energy, and attention a ton, and I'm excited to catch you next time. We got some really cool episodes in the pipeline, so stay tuned.